Welcome to the V&A Podcast, bringing you behind the scenes of the Victoria and Albert Museum, the world's greatest museum of art and design. I'm Glenn Adamson, head of research at the V&A. At the end of 2014, the V&A will open the latest in its series of major projects, a set of seven galleries devoted to Europe between the years 1600 and 1800. The galleries will include 1,000 objects, including some of the most magnificent works of art and design in the museum's collections, made for figures including Louis XIV, Marie Antoinette, and Catherine the Great. In this episode, we'll discuss the interpretation that visitors will experience in this new space. Here to discuss the Europe 1600 to 1800 galleries are Lucy Trench, head of interpretation for the project, and Evelyn Welch, professor in Renaissance Studies at King's College London. Professor Welch also serves as a trustee of the V&A. So Lucy, let's begin with you. And I have one simple question to begin with, which is, what is museum interpretation?
Well, that's not a simple question. I think interpretation is one of those words which everybody in the museum profession just takes for granted. They know what it means. Outside the museum profession, nobody has the faintest idea what it means. As I've discovered, if you talk to people, really it's about giving objects meaning, a meaning which is interesting and relevant to quite a wide range of people. And in the bad old days, which is long ago, curators used to get out their favourite objects and arrange them around the gallery and put labels, which were either very long or very short, and that was it. And now we make much bigger efforts to group objects in such a way which is meaningful and to create little narratives around them. But of course, what happens is that these meanings change all the time, and that the meaning an object might have for you is different than the meaning it might have for me or for Evelyn, and it'll change in subsequent generations. So these meanings are never fixed. And one of the big changes in the Europe galleries, those galleries were put together, I think, in the 70s by Peter Thornton. And although interpretation might not have had the status it has now, I'm sure people thought very seriously about what objects they were choosing and why they were choosing them and why they were putting them together. And now we're completely overhauling that, and we're trying to maintain some of the old meanings which were conveyed in the old galleries, as well as creating new ones for ourselves.
Can you give us an idea of who's involved in museum interpretation? Obviously, curators is one group of people in the museum, but there are other professionals who contribute as well.
Well, in the learning department, we have the educators, and each new gallery project has a lead educator and sometimes an assistant educator. So we sit at the core of interpretation, but we liaise all the time with curators. I sit on the concept team with four curators, so we talk, you know, weekly, almost daily, about interpretation and displays and the choice of objects. But we also liaise with designers, graphic designers, architects, and I think this relationship between the object, the text, and the 3D environment, the designed environment that it's in, is really key. And to make galleries successful, they all have to work together in a completely synchronized way and not fight against each other or turn their back on each other, which is what you see in less successful galleries.
Okay, Evelyn, maybe we could turn to the Europe galleries themselves, and I'll ask you another big and not so simple question, which is to ask for your view on what the big transformative changes in Europe in the 17th and 18th centuries were. Obviously, that's what's reflected in the galleries. That's the story we're telling. So you, as a historian, of course, are very knowledgeable about this period. What do you think the big narratives are?
So between 1600 and 1800, the range of changes is extraordinary. The kinds of foods that you eat, drinks that you drink, clothing that you wear, the political culture that you believe in, and even how you conceptualize your own body has been absolutely changed across Europe in this period. So let's take three areas. If we think about trade and the world, if you think in the 16th century, essentially that was an age where discoverers found new continents. Come 1600, what you've got is a group of primarily men in Amsterdam and in London, but also Paris and in Stockholm and in Copenhagen, thinking, how do we make money out of this? And by the 18th century, they've absolutely worked out how to make money out of this. Now, of course, one of the other major changes that comes with that is the political changes. Not only do you have the continent of the Americas that's been discovered, you have this new nation, the concept of a republic, which, of course, is very much looking to France, which has had a revolution, and that's building on and separating from this notion of absolutist monarchy. So you have these new and very heated and really sometimes quite genuinely terrifying, we think of the terror in France, the terrifying debates about who rules, what does it mean to be a citizen, what are the philosophies behind that. And finally, thinking about science and thinking about technological changes that take place here. Though we think of 1800 and the 19th century as being the Industrial Revolution, in fact, the changes in technology, the changes in our ability to see, for example, at the cellular level, to look through microscopes, to look at the stars in a completely different way. So this isn't a sudden change, the 16th century, the 15th century, all of these are times of transformation as well. But nonetheless, there's something intense about this 200-year period where all kinds of certainties are thrown up in the air and, luckily for us, come back down as objects.
And I suppose, Evelyn, that one thing that happens towards the end of that period is, of course, the development of the modern museum itself.
Absolutely. So in this period, you see the invention of a space which is a public space. So in the 16th and 17th centuries, you have a lot of the development of the galleries, of the private collections. And you start to be able in the 17th century to pay small sums. Sometimes they're tickets, sometimes they're bribes to people who allow you in to see other people's collections there. So when John Evelyn is able to see collections, it's often, he says, this is amazing, I gave some money, they opened up the royal collection for me, and I had 3 days in it there in the 17th century. By the 18th century, there's this concept that we ought to be making things that are beautiful and valuable and life-enhancing, open and visible to the public.
So one of the things that we're doing here is telling the story of a period that is in some ways the beginning of our own story as a public museum. So there's a lot to get across there, Lucy. Do you recognize in some of the themes that Evelyn's talking about, trade, scientific knowledge, political change, do you recognize some of the key themes that visitors will see in the galleries?
Yes, very much so. I think that Evelyn has obviously painted the broad picture, which is absolutely right. Our problem is it's not always easy to convey that broad picture through the objects that we have. So just looking at the Europe galleries about the key messages that we've tried to convey through objects, which are not, they're sort of the same as Evelyn's key messages, but they're not entirely the same because we're telling a story through objects, not through words or books. Our key messages are that Europeans took manufactures, materials and imagery from all around the world, that ways of living came to resemble those that we know today. I think that's a very important point, the growth of privacy, individualism, comfort, informality, a much broader and more fluid social sphere. All these are things that happened progressively towards the end of the period and which we would completely take for granted today.
That's interesting. So this is a period in which society itself is becoming perhaps more familiar to us than medieval Renaissance society would have been.
Yes. I mean, I always feel if you sort of were transported back in time to a cafe in Paris in the sort of 1790s or a house in Amsterdam at the same time, you'd sort of roughly know what to do and how to behave. But if you were transported back to the 1590s, I think you might feel really quite struggling, actually.
At a loss.
Yes. Yeah. And then our third key message is that France took over from Italy as a leader of fashionable art and design in Europe. So that's a very much a V&A message, because a V&A is a museum of art and design, rather a museum about history or even a fine art museum. So yes, the fact that France took over from Italy obviously has lots of political and historical ramifications and justification, but it also has an absolute visible impact on art and design, which we can show through our displays.
So that's about France becoming a style leader,
yes,
in a sense.
Yes, yes.
Right. So how do we tell that story, for example?
Well, in our galleries, the first gallery will have, which is called Europe and the World, which is 1600 to about 1720. And that has a very strong emphasis on Spain, Italy and the Netherlands. By the time you get to the last gallery, which is Liberty, Luxury and Power, that gallery is predominantly French, and we do try to shape the displays and create a message which is historically accurate and reflects the way we today feel about art and design.
So one of the fascinating things that you're describing, Lucy, is the challenge of describing a story through objects. Do you let the objects themselves tell the story, even if it ends up being a kind of footnote to what historians think is the kind of key messages, because the objects themselves are the focal point there, or do you try to mix and match so that you have these great objects which might tell the story of Frenchness, but perhaps some objects which are of, let's call them, of more minor nature, which tell the story of trading across continents. So France, for example, isn't a major player in terms of global empires, but it is a major player in terms of the fight for supremacy on the continent. It's a bit like playing a symphony, isn't it? You have to decide what high notes you want to play. Yes. And what you want to be the kind of drumbeat underneath.
It is fascinating. It's a big challenge. I think you come at it from both directions. You have a wish list of what you would like to say in abstract intellectual terms, that these are the big ideas, this is what we want to convey. And then you look at your objects and you see to what extent you can shape those objects into this wish list. And you can't always do that. I mean, there's some things that we would have wanted to say and we simply couldn't say, and you just have to strike them out, particularly since we're not borrowing any objects for these galleries. And that's a really important point. And then on the other hand, we have collections that say certain things extremely strongly. We have a fantastic ceramics collection, so we can do a lot on dining, though oddly enough, we have almost no cutlery of the period. So yeah, you have to sort of play your strengths at the same time as trying to convey the key messages of the period.
Lucy, I suppose a classic problem that museums of the nature of the V&A, at any rate, face in these kinds of historical narratives is that we have lots and lots of fabulous objects that were made for very wealthy people and have been preserved precisely because they are so fabulous. But we often lack depth in collections that reflect, let's say, the everyday person's experience. Are there ways that the Europe 1600 to 1800 galleries team is trying to address that particular problem?
Yes, that's an important one for us, particularly since the Heritage Lottery Fund, who's one of our big sponsors, are very keen that we show the social and geographical and racial diversity of Europe. We've devised certain displays which we think give a more wider social spread than others. For instance, we've got a display on local traditions in the final gallery. So this is in sort of 1760s, 1780s, where we have things like a wonderful Polish sash, which is originally a sort of Oriental Persian concept, but which is adopted by Polish noblemen, though I agree that's not very democratic. But this same display has Greek island embroidery, ceramics, food molds, carved wooden food molds. So there, this is what I suppose you could call regional or peasant art to some extent, regional probably more than peasant. To tell the truth, it sits very uncomfortably with the high-end French stuff. And if you were being a sort of design fascist about it, you would say that our local traditions has to go. But since we're trying to present a more varied and open picture of the period, it'll stay in and it will remind people that it wasn't all Marie Antoinette and French ebonist and furniture makers, that we are trying to indicate that there was something else going on as well. We've also got a display in the Louis XIV gallery about drinking in the early 17th century, which will include a huge range of objects from quite everyday to very high end, and it'll address some of the rituals of drinking and the significance of drinking. So we've sort of, in certain areas, we've tried to make it as demotic as possible.
So everybody drinks.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
And I suppose another example of that, Evelyn, would be dress, because everybody wears clothes as well. So that's a great subject to capture the diversity of Europe at this date. And I know that you're working on a major research project called Fashioning the Early Modern, which is supported by HERA, which stands for Humanities and the European Research Area, HERA. And that is a project that has involved not only your own university, but also the V&A and a number of other partners. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what you're trying to achieve there and how it involves the V&A project.
So the humanities in the European research area, the HERO project, was €1 million of funding that we received to work between Scandinavian universities, University of Copenhagen, University of Stockholm, and the Institute in Helsinki, the Victorian Albert Museum, and Queen Mary University of London. And what was exciting about it is we were asking a really simple question about this period, which is, how do people know what to wear when they get up in the morning? So why is it when in 1600 you got up in the morning, you brushed your hair if you were a man, and in 1700 when you got up in the morning, you put on a wig? Now, so the question we were addressing was literally, how does fashion travel? How do ideas get carried through things? And that, of course, helps to answer some of Lucy's problems. So because the galleries were able to include textiles, because they're able to include images of people getting dressed, although there are not many full costumes in the gallery, nonetheless, you can get that sense of how the things that people put on in the morning, got dressed in, were also reflective of how they saw themselves. When we were doing this work, we were actually handling a lot of objects themselves, learning through garments, learning about what does it mean to actually try to do up a stay, a corset. What does it mean when you are trying to hold your stockings up when all you've got are garters there? Really thinking about the practicalities of that. And I hope visitors to the galleries will get some sense of that, because, of course, one of the ways around some of the challenges of interpretation that Lucy's been describing are you look at the object, but this is going to be a completely web-enabled gallery. So if you're interested in, that's fantastic lace. How was it made? Who made it? How was it worn? Well, what you can do is then go online or get in the catalogue and you can get more information about it. So the object can only carry so much, and then you have to hand over to the interpretation.
Lucy, I wonder if you could give us a sense of the range of interpretive materials that people will see in the Europe galleries.
What people expect and what we will always give them is in situ text. I think that's absolutely the bedrock of interpretation, short, succinct, focused text. In addition to that, we will do films. There will be 4 films about style, about how style spread around Europe. There will be 7 object in focus films in which we take particularly intriguing objects and explore them further. There will be a layer of audios, some of them introductory audios, a sort of curator's introduction. Some will be audios which take a more sort of theoretical stance. We'll do one which is called Belief, Knowledge and Value. So that will enable us to look at ideas of philosophy in a way, which is very difficult to do directly through objects. And then we also have, importantly, we have 3 activity areas where we're trying to bring the activity and the objects and the intellectual purpose of each gallery all together into one space. The first one is the cabinet, about 17th century collecting. The second is the salon, which is about the Enlightenment. And the third one is called the masquerade. And this is where we're doing something entirely new to the V&A. We're going to make a film which will be closely based on the carnival in late 18th century Venice, a film that has that very distinctive look of masks and commedia dell'arte costumes. And visitors will be able to interact physically with this film. So it'll be a more immersive, more environmental experience. It's not going to be a film on a small screen. It's going to be a film which will be around the walls of a small space, and visitors will be able to feel they're entering into this space and participating in it.
Do you have a general feeling about technology in the galleries? I mean, that seems to be on everybody's minds at the moment, how, for example, portable devices like smartphones are changing the way that people experience museums. And you've just given us the example of an activity area that's quite technologically ambitious. Yes. What's your view about this as a professional interpretation specialist?
Well, I think it opens lots of exciting possibilities, because as you go around a gallery, you can take everything with you. You can take the whole web with you, and we can put on mobile devices anything we choose to put on, anything we think visitors will find useful. So it opens up enormous possibilities of allowing visitors to access more information. The question is, do visitors want to access more information? And what we have learnt over the past 20 years is that actually visitors don't want a lot of information in galleries. They primarily want to walk around, have a nice time, look at objects, talk to their friends, and just enjoy it as a social and aesthetic experience, really. And although we know that more and more people have smartphones, there's no evidence that I've seen that suggests that people want to use their smartphones for interpretation. They want them for information, but that's a very different matter. So I think we have to proceed quite cautiously here and perhaps do more evaluation, more research before we invest a lot of money in mobile interpretation.
So, Evelyn, I wonder, from your perspective, not only as a historian, but also as a trustee of the museum, do you have a sense of how the V&A operates as a mechanism for telling history in a general sense? Do we have a personality as a historical institution that might be different to other museums?
So when you come into the V&A, you're coming into a very eclectic institution that is made up of strong curatorial personalities. We know that a lot of the collections were formed by great buyers in the 19th century. So the V&A tells its history of the world through the histories of the personalities who bought the objects, who donated the objects. And I think the great thing about the museum is it doesn't try to disguise this. It doesn't try to say we're a universal history of the world kind of institution. We have no gaps. We tell everything. It tells the story of itself as well as telling the story of the objects, as well as telling the story of the ideas that lie behind them.
I wanted to just finish by asking Lucy one last question, which is, what is your favourite object in the Europe 1600 to 1800 galleries?
Well, that's a tough one. Today I went to have a look at the mechanical tortoise, which is a dear little tortoise, which has got a real tortoise shell on top of it, and it's got little tortoisey feet and little tortoisey head, and on top of it it's got a merman who's riding it like an Indian mahout and prodding its head with a trident. And it moves. It's got a little mechanical mechanism inside. And I went to have a look at it because the clockmaker was there to have a look at it and to see whether we could get it moving for a little film, which we can certainly do. So that's a fun object, which I think the curators don't entirely share my enthusiasm for because it's not a sort of high-class object. But it is very intriguing, and it brings together these ideas of science, the mechanism, the natural world, the fact that it is actually a tortoise, and these little brass feet and brass head move in the most extraordinary tortoisey way. The head sort of comes in and out like that. But it's not an entirely serious object. So perhaps as a more serious object, I'd think of the Endymion cabinet, which is this fabulous ebony cabinet made in Paris in the 1640s with scenes from a contemporary novel. And then when you open out the cabinet, it's got this fabulous marquetry mirrored set, which is like a miniature theatre with the mirrors arranged in such a way that you get vistas into infinity. And when the cabinets like this were used for collections of jewellery, shells, coins, curiosities, and the collector could bring out items from his collection and arrange them on this little stage within the cabinet, and there would be these wonderful sort of effects of these objects going off into infinity. It is an extremely intriguing object, and it's one of the things we will be making an object in focus film on.
So what's wonderful about both of those is they capture that sense of amazement, the secret mechanisms, the secret drawers there, this notion that we are capturing the whole world in our salons,
yes,
in our cabinets, and in what will become London's living room.
Yes.
Well, thanks very much. It sounds like it was a great deal of fun to be alive in the 17th and 18th century, as well as everything else we've talked about. So thank you very much indeed to both Evelyn Welch and also to Lucy Trench for their discussion of interpretation in the European galleries. I hope you've enjoyed listening, and I also hope that you'll join us again for the next episode of the V&A podcast, bringing you behind the scenes of the Victoria and Albert Museum, the world's greatest museum of art and design.